Okay, this is the hour conversations with Linda. Questions for her and also tips. She's looking for stories. You might be a whistleblower. You may have some inside information to a story. Check in with us and she'll go to work on it right here on Coast to Coast AM. Linda, put down on your assignment sheet, check into this, like this orca story from Orlando, Florida, the orca that caught the
right.
worker and thrashed her around and she drowned. Why are these animals doing this?
Well, he grabbed her ponytail, and I heard one of the zoo people talking tonight, I think it was on CNN, and they said this was he's a powerful animal.
12,000 pounder, right?
Yeah, and is a prime orca species and has been one of their prime sperm donors also for creating and keeping the orca population going in the various aquariums and pools. Well, she had a really special professional. She was considered, if not the best, one of the best whale trainers they've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And she was so playful with this whale that I heard tonight that they were second-guessing that the whale really jumped up and grabbed a hold of her ponytail like to play. And that is, I know, is putting a human interpretation.
Yeah, but, you know, it's been involved with two other deaths before that, too.
Well, one was supposedly a guy climbed into the whale pond.
Smart.
At 3 o'clock in the morning, who knows
what
state he was in. And these are wild creatures from the oceans. And for us to blame them, I know that if this beautiful girl were alive right now on this program, she would say, do not hurt this whale in any way. Do not stop the relationship between audiences. 168 million people went through the aquarium and zoo parks in 2009. There are more Americans going to zoos and aquariums than they are going to football games and other things. And right now, hopefully, the fact that people are now more aware, this is not a feature film. This is real. This is a real creature from real oceans that we have in parks, and that there are these wonderful, strong human beings who have learned to work with them in the water and out of the water, but they are still wild creatures and humans, and there's always a risk. And she would have been the first to say that the whale probably just jumped up to play and grabbed her ponytail, and she wasn't watching, and unfortunately, she's in another dimension.
Yeah, very sad indeed. All right, to the phones we go. We'll go to Idaho, west of the Rockies. James, get us started. Hey, James, good morning.
Good morning. Hi, George. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Very interesting program all the way around. I just wanted to give you a little insight on what I think the problem with the bees is all this insane spraying of the weeds with herbicide.
Right.
You know, everybody calls it, I think they use the term pesticide to cover everything, but I've been on this 100-acre little ranchette, I guess you'd call it, but we've got 25 apple trees and 25 or 30 plum trees. Usually there's bees all over the place, but every time they come along here and spray, you know, I live just pretty close to the highway. The highway department sprays, then the county sprays, the fish and game sprays all these little fish screen things. And like one year I noticed, they did it on June 17th. I had thousands of bees like the good old days. And bango, just like that, they disappeared.
Right.
You know,
I think. Yeah, your story is repeated all over, not just this country, but other countries. And it is why France, for example, has been trying to crack down on the use of pesticides, specifically the nicotine-based pesticides.
Mm-hmm.
And the hope is in the United States that some kind of action could be taken to reduce the amount of the neonicotinoids, as they're known, because under laboratory conditions, UC Davis and other places, that they have been able to confirm that a bee exposed to a neonicotinoid pesticide at even the most minute levels. They're not even sure if they've been able to measure down low enough in terms of, is there any exposure that would not cause this problem with the bees? And that is, it blanks their memory. It makes them unable to leave their colony, go out and forage in whatever the field is, and know how to get back to the colony. And the fact that they know this does occur, and that the nicotine-based pesticides are doing something to the brain's mind or brain or nervous center so that it can't return, would be part of the explanation for why, since 2006 and starting that fall, that the first report coming from Mr. Hackenberg in Pennsylvania was missing of, I think it was out of his half of his, all of his colonies, that he didn't have any bees in his colonies. They had disappeared. And so if you take the combination of a nicotine-based pesticide that is having that impact on the orientation of bees, plus what you have just described so eloquently that you have seen with your own eyes happen with the spraying of herbicides and pesticides on fields and bees disappear, and then realize that with genetically modified crops beginning, unfortunately, to take over in a lot of places, those crops tend to reduce the biodiversity. And so where we started at the beginning of the program on honeybees, that if you find through research that if you have one pollen, even if it has a lot of protein in it, those bees are not going to thrive, that they need multiple protein, just like if we were fed only white bread and we had nothing else to eat,
horrible,
we'd get very, very sick.
Okay, thanks, Linda. Next up, we go to Grand Rapids, Michigan. First-time caller, Raymond, you're on with us. Hi, Raymond.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Norrie. Good morning, Ms. Howe. How are you this night down there? All right. But anyway, Ms. Howe, I have talked to you before on the telephone. I had communicated with you through email. I had sent you my website about a photo that I had taken back in 84 while flying back from Los Angeles to Chicago.
What was that, Raymond? Refresh me, because I don't know about it.
Okay. Yeah, this is Ms. Howe I'm talking to right now. Oh, okay. What it is, well, can I get my website out?
No, you can't. Not at this point.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'm glad I asked. But anyway, it's a photo that I had taken back in 84 of an image that I had seen while flying back from Los Angeles to Chicago, back way to Grand Rapids. But it's somewhere midway, close to O'Hara Airport. There's a large image shaped like had a shape to it like a fetus. But it was so large, it looked like on an adult side. It had a long cone-shaped head and an S-curve body. And when I got back to Grand Rapids, I had it processed, and come to find out, not only did I have a large image, but I have multiple smaller images, some human, some animal, and some unknown images.
Huh. Well, you get thousands of emails, Linda. I don't know if you remember getting this one or not.
I don't, but are you talking about something that is in the sky? Are you talking about clouds in these shapes? What are you referencing?
Okay, what I'm referencing is that it is a phenomenal aerial photo, and for me to try to determine whether it's in clouds or on the land itself is it's somewhere to me in the thing of quantum physics.
All right, why don't you give them? Let's get the email address out, Linda, and let you get it to them. Okay.
Okay. Why don't you resend to earthfiles@earthfiles.com? And for other Coast listeners, just think of a reporter who files news about the Earth. So it's always earthfiles@earthfiles.com. And I welcome your emails, your questions, your videos, your photos. But I can't always get to everything. And in this case, I'm not certain what this sounds like, but it's the kind of thing that if I look at it, and I know several people who look at photos, I could make a determination and see whether it should be forwarded. So thank you.
All right, very good. We've got lots of calls, so we shall move on, Raymond. We'll go to Steve in Youngstown, Ohio. Good morning, Stephen.
Oh, good morning. Hi, George. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a comment. Fantastic show tonight, too, by the way.
She always does a great job, doesn't she?
Yeah, excellent show tonight.
Thank you.
The mummies of China, I believe several years back, I saw a special. It might have been Discovery Channel or whatnot, but I just wanted to add my own two cents for it. There's mention of Caucasian-type people found. I think there was another burial that they found in Pazuric, and I'm probably not pronouncing it correct, somewhere in Siberia. But the mounds and the face masks were found on these Caucasoid-type people as well. And I don't know, there's a lot of different theories out, but Scythosarmatian people, I believe they were called, they were like steppe dwellers. They stretched pretty far from China all the way to the Black Sea.
Right.
And,
this new DNA that I'll be able to report on the next coast in March, what the definitive study is on the DNA so far, but you heard him say in the interview that at least that Y chromosome on the male side is Western Europe. And I'm looking in my own Earth Files report in front of me of a photograph that I put in there for comparison to some of the tools and objects that were found with some of the mummies, especially in Churchin. And
right.
You can see on, for example, the yarn spindles have those triple spirals and the box is carved. And when you go down to New Grange, which was Celtic, and it goes back as far as maybe 5,000 years ago, you're looking at exactly the same patterns that are on both the spindle and on the box. And I think that the fact that there is this similarity in patterns is what made people say in the beginning, these are Celtic mummies in Western China. The bigger mystery is, what really is the source of the Celts? What really was the source and the inspiration for these particular very convoluted, complex spiral and wave patterns, of which Newgrange in Ireland, going back 5,000 years, is one of the best examples. And here we're out in Western China, in the big desert on the edges. And here is this discovery of more than 400 fair-skinned, fair-haired, tall, that one Yingpan man is 6 feet 6 inches tall, dressed in this gorgeous garments. They're still beautiful after all of these centuries. And they appear to be, as now the DNA is going to say, Western Europe. But what was the flow and ebb of the peoples in all of Europe? And where did everybody come from? And what was the distribution that is becoming increasingly more complex and mysterious? The further we go back in time, it seems the more mysterious it all becomes.
Exactly. I've even heard theories about possibly a Scythian Celtic connection going way, way back. And, DNA will definitively prove. we'll have our answers thanks to modern technology.
All right, great. Thank you, Steve.
And who were the Celts, really?
Have you ever done any reports on giants, Linda, at all? I know Stephen Quayle does a lot of that.
Well, the giants came up in several aspects, both on the UFO side and in the crop circles, interestingly enough, because there is that section in Genesis which talks about the giants with the six fingers and the six toes. It's right there in the Bible. And that those giants were supposed to be the product of the sexual intercourse of the gods, or the angels, depending upon interpretation, and the fair females of man, and that the product were the six-fingered, six-toed giants. Well, if you jump to England in crop circles and you go to the Longborough in Wiltshire, which is one of the areas, the Longborough is right across the street from Big Silbury Hill, and Silbury Hill is not far from Avebury, and so you have this wonderful astronomical complex, and every summer going back at least to, I'd say you have to go all the way back to the end of the 80s, and there were patterns that started showing up in crops there, and every summer there is a spectacular formation somewhere in that area. Well, one day I was on the Longborough and was going to go and explore a crop formation, and there were some people that were in a little tour, and there was a man who had some knowledge about the Longborough and that part of England. And I listened with great fascination, and then later did a lot of reading on my own, that in that Longborough area, they found, archaeologists, British archaeologists, found 9-foot tall skeletons. Now, from a human point of view, a human shape that is 9 feet or taller, I think that's starting to get into giant territory from a human point of view.
I think so, too.
So, archaeologically, in Great Britain, 9-foot-tall skeletons were found in that Longborough area. Who are they, and what is the relationship between those tall ancient skeletons, the mysterious Celts, with pre-Celtic and Celtic, with these patterns, the swirl patterns that are found all the way to Western China? And what is the relationship between those tall, a 6.5-foot tall man, Yingpan man, in Western China with the tall Celt and these 9-foot tall giants? Is there any relationship? And this is what, Professor Mayer, I understand from an academic point of view, you want to prove all of the relationships because there may be a lot of surprises still to learn about these 400 and some, we would say, what they do say, Europoid Caucasian mummies. Well, maybe we're going to, if we keep our minds open and we don't lock into exactly where did they all come from, Celtic or whatever, we may yet have mystery after mystery start coming in front of us and being answered that can give us insights into humans going back 5,000 or more years. And I think that is the exciting part of science. Don't jump to conclusions, but do look at the patterns. And the patterns inside of the mummies and their tools themselves link to what we have come to associate anyway with Western Europe and the Celts.
Absolutely. Stay with us. We're going to be back with final phone calls with Linda Moultonow. By the way, May 1st, those of you in the St. Louis area, looks like I'm going to be at the Left Banks Books for a book signing for Journey to the Light. So I'll have more information on that. So just circle that. May 1st in St. Louis, book signing, Journey to the Light. And also on Saturday, March 13th, I'll be in San Diego at the new Science of Aliens exhibit at the San Diego Air and Space Museum at Balboa Park. So come on by for that. Keep listening to Kogo there in San Diego for details, as they're going to give out some free tickets, too. I'll be back in a moment with Linda Moultonow and you. Got a whittle off of vacation day. Ian Punnett will sit in for me tomorrow, and I shall be right back on Monday with an incredible program with Michael Cremo as we talk about forbidden archaeology. Tuesday, Russell Targ joins us as we talk about his work with remote viewing. Hank Wesselman joins us as we talk about spirit medicine, healing in the sacred realms. And then on Thursday, a major program on NASA with Richard C. Hoagland from theenterprisemission.com and also a number of guests with Richard. And then back to Friday again next week, we'll have open lines on Coast to Coast AM. Back in a moment with final calls with Linda Moultonow. Okay, we'll go right back to calls with Linda Moultonow. Linda, give me a quick update, by the way, because this was before my time. I know you've talked about it before.
Mm-hmm.
Arts parts. I still get emails about that. I should just refer them to you, but
yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that story.
It's very important. It's the layered bismuth and magnesium zinc. And these were, I think there were six. Each piece was about 2.5 inches long by about an inch and a quarter wide. They definitely had a curved shape to each one. And they came in a box after the sender had originally sent aluminum. So we got a box that had aluminum pieces in it, and I got those tested. They were 99%+ pure aluminum. Then came the box with the bismuth and the magnesium layered. And one of the first things that I started doing when I got a piece of this is I sent it to a professor in a university who had access to energy dispersive spectroscopy and some other pieces of technology so that we could very finely and accurately find out what were in these very thin layers. And to give you an idea, if each piece, the layers were only about at the thickest, between 1/8 of an inch to 1/4 of an inch, meaning the whole thing wasn't any higher than that, and there could be as many as 32 layers in that section, and those layers alternated very regularly as pure bismuth with 97.6% magnesium and 2.4% zinc alloy. And all these layers alternated. And on one side, it was a very beautiful, bright silver that did not in any way delaminate, or none of these came apart. And on the opposite side, it was dark, bismuth, black. So one side would look like bismuth and the other side would look like silver. And when we got the identification that we were dealing with pure bismuth layers sandwiched in between the magnesium zinc, I started calling up metallurgists and exotic materials manufacturers and missile and jet and technology people, and I ended up with a notebook. I think I had 56 people that I talked to on this. And one was on the East Coast in the New York, New Jersey area. He was the manager of an exotic metals place. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget, I was calling everybody up and saying, just straightforwardly, here, I have a lab test in front of me from EDS. This is what it is. And the guy started laughing. He said, impossible. You cannot put bismuth layered with magnesium. Not possible. No one would do that. And that was the first time that I had a really strong reaction to those combinations. And then the further I went, the more I realized that there was nobody out there anywhere who had heard of bismuth being layered in micron. These are micron layers, 1 to 4 microns of bismuth, 100 to 200 microns of magnesium zinc, all alternating in layers. And even under a microscope, it was fascinating because there was a general up and down, how to explain this, was it as if you had all these layers that are alternating, but that the layers themselves seemed to have a regular undulating pattern. And that led to questions about, could this be a highly sophisticated, I'm going to say, a metal designed to have a reaction inside of magnetic fields? And we have done all kinds of stuff. The material, I've had it in a lab in California where they were testing materials looking for, they were straight out looking for neutralizing gravity. Would it be possible that in a certain magnetic field that you could have resonances that would have an impact on certain constructed crystal metals, that they would rise, that they would neutralize gravity? We also, probably the most interesting that's on video, we monitored and documented this. If you take one of these pieces and you put it on a plastic so that it is above, whether you're using a Van de Graaff generator or whether you're using a Tesla coil, either one, and you're generating a field and you put a piece of bismuth magnesium on a, say, a plastic cap, that's the insulator, and about I think we put it 2 feet to 3 feet away. We did a 7 hertz radio signal. And as soon as that 7 hertz radio signal was turned on with the Van de Graaff generator or the Tesla coil operating, the bismuth magnesium piece would begin to move like a crab sideways. We've got this on videotape. And that was really fascinating, because why would it be moving right to left or left to right? And that was one of the more interesting pieces of research, because it meant it was interacting with something in those fields. And it had been suggested, actually, to me by somebody who claimed knowledge from China Lake and Edwards in California about applying that 7 hertz radio signal in the presence of either a Tesla coil or a Van de Graaff generator, and putting the bismuth magnesium, which he claimed that he himself had handled at China Lake 30-some years ago, back engineering something that he didn't understand. Well, the very fact that we got a reaction, to my mind, today, I've had this in the hands of superconductor researchers. I've had it at the Cranford Lab in England to look for what's called molecular organized structure, which they can examine with crystallography. And the result was officially that this is a highly structured piece of technology. And the final bottom line today, this is 2010. Art and I started working on those boxes of stuff in 1996.
God.
So we're talking
15 years ago.
Yeah. Okay. 14, in those 15 years, I have talked with Hal Puthoff in Austin at the Advanced Physics Institute and many others. Could you take a piece, examine it, take it to Los Alamos or any lab that you work with on any kind of a regular basis, and ask them, from your meaning that they would have some leverage with a lab, would you, can you reproduce this? That's all I wanted to know. Can anybody reproduce this? And when Art and I were doing those shows, every show I would report newly what I was discovering and say, is there anyone out there who can reproduce 1 to 4 microns of pure bismuth? Because we knew that from an ion microprobe. We knew exactly that it was pure bismuth, and that the magnesium zinc layer was the 97.6 and 2.4, but there was another anomaly. I took this back. Art and I split the bill. I went to Carnegie Institute. I spent 8 hours with an ion microprobe man going and working with this piece of bismuth magnesium. And he did one test over and over and over again, because he considered it quite anomalous. The bismuth magnesium piece that allegedly came from the bottom of a triangular-shaped craft in the White Sands Trinity area in 1947, that was the story, would give off, if the ion microprobe in Carnegie Institute, 60 times the amount of ionization ions as a normal piece of magnesium that we had as control. It held up over time, meaning no matter how many times he took the bismuth magnesium piece that allegedly came from the bottom of a non-human, non-terrestrial, triangular-shaped craft from New Mexico and put it into this particular test, it would emit 60 times more negatively or positively charged ions in the normal piece of magnesium. And he wrote this up and gave me, and it's in my book, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2, all of that work and the spectra and the photographs are all in my third book, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2. And when I asked him, I said, well, could that be an insight into what the function of this is? Because at that point, and think of it, it's still today, nobody has duplicated it. nobody in the exotic metals world or the advanced technology world works with bismuth and magnesium zinc at these micron layers. And no one knows what the function would be, including the man who sent this, saying that his grandfather had pulled this off the bottom of this triangular-shaped craft and that these pieces had glowed for 3 hours in the desert in on White Sands property. Well, what if there is something about the ionization process that so many eyewitnesses have reported about these craft in the air? What if there is something about the fact that this bismuth magnesium will give off 60 times the amount of ionization that a magnesium, normal magnesium would, is a key to some function that it has or had in that technology?
Out of this world, Linda.
And this question has never been answered, and there's anybody listening who has access to a lab, a legitimate lab, it has to be vetted, and I have to have a letter of agreement that the piece can be tested, but it has to be returned to me. And everybody has done this over all these years. Every scientist has done this. They've used up little bits, but I've always gotten the pieces back.
Good.
I'm looking for legitimate scientific experimentation, and the one thing that would be valuable, is there any lab anywhere that can duplicate this micron alternating layer of bismuth and magnesium zinc?
To the final calls we go. Skype line, Mike in the state of Washington. Go ahead, Mike. You're up with us.
Okay.
Thanks.
This goes back to what Linda had been talking about earlier about the giants.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay. It feels a little inappropriate following on the arts parts question, but I just wondered if you tried to coordinate that with what had been found in the Indian mountains in America. When I was a kid, I grew up in Western Pennsylvania, and we had a mound, and there was actually a very large skeleton, and my mom got scared and demanded that we move out of there.
Really?
I just wondered, yeah.
Well, all over it seems to me that there have been pockets of archaeology in various places on this planet where these big skeletons have been found. Western Pennsylvania, I'm not specifically educated about the discovery of very tall skeletons in Western Pennsylvania. But I know that there appears to be archaeological evidence that suggests that Michigan, which is not too far from Western Pennsylvania, has had some kind of a significant mining history, perhaps, of copper and other things in that Great Lakes area that could not be explained necessarily by the American Indians and then the influx of Europeans into the United States. So who was in the Great Lakes area, I guess I want to say, doing deep mines and mining perhaps copper? And could there be any kind of a relationship between that mystery, the tall skeletons, that might relate to an other than Homo sapien presence on this planet, perhaps more than once?
Let's go next to Lori in British Columbia. You're up with us on the international line. Hi, Lori. Good morning.
Good morning. Linda, I'd like to ask you about the pollinators, you know,
right.
Bees. What about hummingbirds?
Well, the hummingbirds do play a pollinating role, and the difference, I think, is that the hummingbirds migrate, and the hummingbirds move south in the winter and north, and that there are, at least as far as I know right now, there seems to be a general decline also in bird populations all over the planet. But the hummingbird is in a slightly different category because it operates in a different way and is migratory, whereas the honeybee and the bumblebee and the butterflies, they get caught and nailed by the pesticides and the lack of pollen, whereas the deer hummingbird, they will go out and seek more flowers. And the flowers right now on the hummingbird side may not be as narrowed in diversity as what's happening with crops and why the pollinators may be going downhill, that they don't have enough variety in pollens and proteins. And combine that with the terrible nicotine-based pesticides and the fact that they've also had this terrible attack of the Varroa mites for the last 20 years. And we've got this wonderful and necessary and valuable creature on this planet, the bees and the pollinators, that are just seemingly going downhill every year. And that one of the big things that we could do that probably would reverse it would be to stop using pesticides and herbicides and allowing crops to be diverse, not letting genetically modified crops take over and reduce everything down to one genetically modified crop. I think that is a very scary situation as we're going into the future, and the world, instead of reinforcing the diversity of life, the power of the diversity of life, we seem to have corporations that want to control the food supply and diminish the diversity. And hopefully the whole human family is going to realize, like India is realizing rapidly, this doesn't work, and we need to keep as many varieties, as many crops for the hummingbirds, for the bees, and for humans to survive.
Linda, what's up on travel for you?
Let's see. We are at the end of February. I'm going Monday. I'm going to spend a week at the Lunar and Planetary Institute conference in Houston. I love it. It is like going out into the solar system for a week with the scientists who are studying all of the planets and the moons and learning more about what is going to happen with, hopefully, NASA looking and continuing its robotic exploration of our solar system and the exciting Mars Science Laboratory that will hopefully get launched. And it will be our first true organic equipped lander to look for organics on Mars. All of this is going to be discussed with all of the new and latest data and images. And I'm telling you, George, I've been to about a dozen of these LPI conferences. And at the end, by Friday, you truly feel like you have been out on Enceladus.
That's one of the things. Thanks, Linda. Good reports tonight. For Jason Bowers, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.